Hello and welcome. I'm Dr. Fred Lovin. On behalf of CME Outfitters, I would like to welcome and thank you for joining us for today's question and answer session for the educational activity, Right Patient, Right Treatment, Right Time, Utilizing Early High-Efficacy Therapies to Improve Outcomes in Relapsed and Remitting MS. We've already begun receiving questions, but just a reminder, you can submit your questions in the Submit Question button on your screen. We'll also be monitoring the Twitter feed for hashtag MSCare. So let's get started. So the first question is actually a very important one. It says, can you comment on drug-drug interactions with the newer treatments for relapsed or remitting MS and contraindications we should be educating patients about? So the short answer is, I'm still trying to wrap my head around this. The latest S1P1 approvals agents, siponimod and ozanimod, all have issues in their labels about CYP genomics. So, for example, in Mazen, you have to genotype for the CYP2C9 metabolic marker because that will determine the dosing. But there's also in the label discussion about how various types of CYPs may increase the siponimod exposure or decrease the siponimod exposure. And so I strongly advise you to look at the label and make sure you don't have any drug-drug interactions in that regard. Similarly, with ozanimod, there's also in the label that co-administration is not recommended for strong CYP2C8 inhibitors and also for BCRP inhibitors and for strong CYP2C8 inducers. So you need to look and see about those interactions. I can't tell you which drugs they are because I haven't sorted that out. Another aspect of the label, which is not quite a medication, but you should keep in mind, not recommended that patients with MS, especially those receiving any of the immunomodulators, receive live vaccines. Keep that in mind as we develop vaccines for COVID. That we really want to avoid live vaccines in patients with MS in general, and especially those on immunomodulating or immunosuppressive therapy. Next question is, what factors do you consider when sequencing therapy for MS? So this is pretty much what we were talking about for this presentation. So there's multiple factors, as we discussed. First is the reason for sequencing. And the main reasons that you would consider sequencing switching would be for a breakthrough in disease activity, a safety signal, poorly tolerated side effects, or, and something we haven't spent a lot of time discussing, and really there's no literature on just yet, the possibility of de-escalating from a higher efficacy therapy to a lower efficacy therapy. So for the first three, I mean, safety and side effects are pretty straightforward. You know, their patients aren't tolerating one of the side effects. Then that would be a reason to switch. When you're switching for safety or side effects, then efficacy becomes the secondary factor, and really tolerability becomes the primary factor. If you're switching because you feel they're getting an inadequate response from the therapy you're on, then you want to go to a higher efficacy therapy. And we talked about this in the presentation. We have drugs that we consider high efficacy agents, but for the most part, they've either been tested against placebo or against drugs that clearly have lower efficacy, but we don't know really head-to-head good data for how you choose which high efficacy therapy. So then it becomes a matter of dosing frequency, route of administration, things like JC status if you were thinking about natalizumab. So those are just some of the considerations on sequencing. To make sure that you do this as part of a joint decision-making process with your patient. Next question regards high efficacy versus safety. How do you start that discussion with patients? So this is an important discussion to have with patients. And so we usually lay this out as saying, well, here are therapies. We have the ones that have been around for a long time, which are very safe, but we think we have higher efficacy therapies. Now, you as the clinician may already have a feeling as to which direction you want to take the patient in. So if it's someone who has early MS, not much in the way of lesion load on the MRI, but a good recovery from a single attack or two, then you may say to them, so why don't we go with a safe therapy first, safer therapy first. On the other hand, if you think this is someone who has a lot of activity, a lot of change from the MRI, poor recovery from their exacerbation, you may skew and say, look, I think you ought to be on this higher efficacy drug, but here are the safety considerations. Then you give the patient a chance to sort of express what their concerns are. And we do have individuals who come in and say, well, look, give me the strongest thing you can because this disease scares me. We have others who come in and the first thing they say is, well, how long has that drug been around? Or I'm really concerned about what I'm putting in my body. So talk to me about safety first. And so that helps guide you in the discussion in which direction you would be going and get an idea of what the patient's thinking about as well. Again, the important point here is this joint decision-making, that the patient should be on board and participate in what you're doing rather than just saying, well, this is a drug I think you should take, you know, goodbye. On the other hand, and that's a very paternalistic approach, patients also don't like when they say, well, here are three different drugs. Go home and read about them and tell me which one you want to take. That also is not an effective strategy. But rather, back and forth, your job educating the patient is ultimately going to make the decision, but telling them what the relative benefits and risks are. Okay, so here, next question. For a patient who wants to stay home as much as possible to avoid COVID exposure, which disease monitors would you prefer to use, considering not only self-administration, but also needs for laboratory testing or likelihood of side effects that would require in-person visits? This is a very timely question, and it also doesn't get to the issue of whether some disease modifying therapies may cause increased concern in patients who might get infected with COVID. And I'll deal with that first. We don't have a lot, and with my colleagues in this country, we haven't seen any specific therapy that put patients at increased risk. The Europeans have suggested that perhaps there's an increased risk of worse COVID infection in individuals who are taking anti-CD20 therapies. We haven't seen that here yet, but I just raised it, and more data will be coming because the numbers still aren't large. In terms of startups and such for patients who want to stay in the home, then you could use any of the early agents, say injectables, glucuronide acetate, or interferon, both of which would be perfectly safe if there was COVID exposure. It's actually interesting about interferon because you utilize interferon as part of your initial response to a virus like SARS-CoV-2. You could put them on one of the orals, for example, dimethylfumarate, because that wouldn't require any laboratory testing, but you do have the issue of potential GI side effects. Teriflunomide would be a good choice because it's well tolerated, but you have the issue of having to get liver function studies early on monthly. Most of the other agents you'd have to, for example, with Ebola mode, you have the issue of getting, you know, a first dose observation, cardiograms, ophthalmologic evaluation, and such. So I hope that, that gets to some of the issues there. Okay, here's a question. How do the S1Bs compare in safety? Well, they have been compared head-to-head. The newer S1P1s that have been approved with a dose titration at the start, which for most patients avoids the need for first dose observation, as we have with fingolimod. But they still have cardiac issues that have to be dealt with, and the other safety issues look to be fairly similar in terms of having to monitor lymphocyte counts and liver function, eyes for macular edema. It's too early to say about the potential for opportunistic infections, but I would expect that they would be similar to what we see with fingolimod. Here's another question. I have a 40-year-old obese female with new CIS with an enhancing C-spine lesion and two non-enhancing periventricular lesions on opposite sides. Maternal aunt and another paternal cousin have MS. Is this enough for diagnosis and treatment, or do I still need a spinal tap? Okay, 40-year-old female, CIS, I assume the CIS was a typical CIS, which would mean an optic neuritis, a brainstem cerebellar inflammatory disorder, or a partial myelitis. So assuming that that's the CIS, this individual meets criteria for multiple sclerosis in time and space by MRI, because there is a cervical spine lesion and periventricular lesion. And there's enhancing and non-enhancing lesions. Now there is a, this sort of depends on how orthodox you are in reading the McDonald criteria, because the McDonald criteria for dissemination in time said that if you have a brain MRI, there's enhancing and non-enhancing lesions at the same time, that that would be a substitute for dissemination in time. Here, the enhancing lesion is in the spine, and that really wasn't addressed in that study, but I consider it the same. If you wanted to be conservative, you can do a spinal tap, but otherwise, I think, you know, this, I think this is MS. Whether it formally meets McDonald or not, it depends on how you deal with that enhancing lesion in the spine. And it's a good question. I'll discuss that with my colleagues. Okay, next. When you initiate treatment with high efficacy disease-modifying therapies in a patient with CIS or first episode of MS, how soon, how frequently do you assess the treatment response? How often and how do you monitor for infection or other adverse events, particularly in patients who want to avoid unnecessary trips outside their home during the pandemic? So if you're starting a high-efficacy disease-modifying therapy in an early MS patient or even a late patient, so we assess, I like to follow people every 3 months. Some people will do 6 months, but that's personal preference. Certainly patients should know to call in if they have any side effects. For infection, there's no infection monitoring you do per se unless you've started them on natalizumab, in which case you want to check for JC antibody titers at least twice a year. And then you probably want to do a screening MRI. I like to do the baseline MRI if I start someone therapy at 3 months and then use that as my baseline moving forward to the therapy. Other of my colleagues prefer 6 months. But either way, that's another way to follow individuals to see how they're doing. Okay, how are you managing MS via telemedicine? When do you bring patients into the office because they need assessment that cannot be performed by a teleconsultation? So we're doing a lot of telemedicine now. and for monitoring patients on disease-modifying therapies has been working, I think, very well. The time when I want to bring someone into the office is when they've had a flare-up that I need to assess how much impairment the flare-up has produced, or if they have gradual worsening over time, and I want to get a sense of how bad they've done, then we'll bring them into the office for the assessment, because some of these things are hard to tell on telehealth. There are other types of flare-ups, but theoretically I could tell if someone had a brainstem flare-up, for example, I probably could see that using telehealth. Testing motor function I find more challenging in terms of being able to quantitate it. Okay, next, what evidence is there regarding influenza vaccination for MS patients? So the evidence is old. I think my colleague Aaron Miller wrote a paper on this, I'm thinking back in the late 1990s, but don't hold me to that date. But it showed that influenza vaccination was safe for MS patients, and that MS patients, when they do get the flu, actually do pretty poorly. They're quite sick. So we recommend influenza vaccination, but let me importantly say it has to be the injectable, not the nasal spray. I don't even know if they're still using the nasal spray, the flu mist, but that's a live virus, and we don't recommend that. But the regular injected influenza vaccine, we think, is a good idea. Okay, let's see next. Are there any data on whether patients taking DMT for MS have tested positive for COVID are less likely to generate antibody responses and more potential? So this is a great question. And so we don't know the answer yet. We're collecting this information now because it is a real concern. We know that for almost all of the immunomodulators, there is an attenuation of vaccination response. And so not only do we have to worry about whether they develop antibodies after they get COVID, we have to worry that they'll be able to develop antibodies after taking the vaccine. Some do it more than others. For the most part, our disease-modifying therapies still produce protective levels of antibodies, even though it's not as high as one would think in the general population. The group that I'm going to be most concerned about and follow more carefully are those who are on anti-CD20 medications, because they are probably the group at most risk of not developing protective immunity. Okay, here's a good question. Why was the optic nerve omitted from the McDonald criteria? So there's no question optic nerve is involved in multiple sclerosis. And I fully expect that the next time we meet to redo McDonald, that optic nerve will get in there. The reason it wasn't included was not because the optic nerve is not important, but rather because if someone presented with an optic neuritis and an enhancing lesion in the optic nerve and had one small juxtacortical lesion or a small periventricular lesion, they would meet the diagnostic criteria for multiple sclerosis. And we were a little concerned that that might lead to misdiagnosis. But as we collect more data on the optic nerve, which is what's been driving this on of late, I expect we'll find ways to include it. Do you have any more data now compared with July about whether use of therapies that cause lymphopenia are associated with increased risk of severe illness or mortality with COVID? And the answer is no, we do not have data that suggests that those agents producing lymphopenia are at increased risk of severe illness. We haven't seen it yet. Again, we're putting the data together, but that signal has not arisen. It's a good point because some of our therapies produce lymphopenia, and lymphopenia also occurs with COVID infection. Let's see. How do you manage patients that want to take a wait-and-see approach to treatment out of fear associated with diagnosis? Would love to hear your perspective. So these are people who always worry me. They're the ones who want to wait and see, or they want to, worse than this, they want to try some holistic therapy that their best friend's uncle told them cured his MS. these will worry us because we end up seeing these people down the road with more severe disease and disability. So I think you have to educate patients on what the risks are, what the risks of residual impairment after any flare-up that you haven't avoided, and that's over 50% residual dysfunction. But you also have to respect the patient's decision and keep an eye on them and watch them closely, monitor MRI scans for subclinical activity. These folks are a challenge, but that's important for you to maintain the vigilance with them. Does neurofilament light play a role in your choice of therapy or how you treat a patient? Not yet. So neurofilament light looks to be right now a better marker of inflammation than it is of progression. I'm hopeful that we'll be able to use neurofilament light in the future to determine whether our therapies are working or not, but we're not there yet. How would you manage a patient with consistently low lymphocyte count on phlebolamide, especially during COVID? Well, the COVID doesn't affect our choice right now in terms of lymphocytes, as I mentioned a little earlier. The low lymphocyte count on phlebolamide, as long as it's 200 and higher, we just follow them. If they go below 200, then I think about switching to another therapy. Can you talk about targets for the S1P1 and CD20 treatments? How do they work, and what about newer agents? So the sphingosine 1 phosphate 1 modulators target that receptor anywhere in the body. On lymphocytes, that receptor is necessary for lymphocytes to egress out of lymph nodes. So when you modulate that receptor, as you do with the S1P1 therapies, the lymphocytes stay in the lymph nodes. But you also have the other effects around the body, although less so with S1P1, for example, less cardiac issues. And so they're an anti-trafficking agent. But like all the anti-trafficking, and I should have mentioned this earlier, there is a concern that if individuals stop therapy, that they may get rebound flare-ups. And that's relatively unique to the anti-trafficking agents, which would be either natalizumab, phlebolamide, siponimod, and ozanimod. So one has to be careful about that. We haven't demonstrated it yet with siponimod and ozanimod, but because it has been reported with phlebolamide, I suspect it may occur with them too, although differing half-lives of the medications may impact whether that rebound relapse behavior occurs. In terms of the CD20s, that's different. There you're eliminating a population of lymphocyte B cells and you're driving them down to zero. And getting it to B cell function, we don't have enough time to do all of that. But they are involved with antigen presentation, with cytokine production. They may be involved within the central nervous system. What we don't think CD20s are doing is having an effect on antibody treatment. That's part of their beneficial therapeutic activity. And then we have a question. Do you ever de-escalate therapy in patients whose lesions are reduced or they're asymptomatic? So we've been thinking about this. This de-escalation, if you think about it in terms of escalation and or an induction strategy, you know, so escalation, you're starting with a safe agent that may not be the most efficacious, and then looking to see how they do, and if they have evidence of activity, you increase until you turn off that activity. And then theoretically, you could at some point de-escalate. Similarly, with induction therapy, you give a high efficacy drug to really knock things out, knock out the immune system, and then somewhere down the road, you switch to a maintenance therapy with something that may be safer. But no one's done that yet, and so we don't know. So it makes sense to think about de-escalation. The problem is, of course, if someone's doing well on a therapy, it may be because of the therapy, and therefore de-escalation could cause increased disease activation. We don't have the data to answer the question. It seems like a logical thing to do, but we just don't know yet. in a patient with clinically isolated syndrome, yes or no, and with therapy. So clinically isolated syndrome, again, a typical one, optic neuritis, partial myelitis, brainstem, cerebellar, or inflammatory disorder with abnormalities on the MRI that look like MS, we treat as MS. And there's at least 7 studies that show that treating those patients, they'll do better. And you can treat them with any of the agents that are available for relapsing forms of multiple sclerosis. Can you talk about BTK inhibitors? This is an interesting molecule. It's a new mechanism of action. We have some phase 2 data for 2 of the BTK. These are Bruton's tyrosine kinase inhibitors. 2 of them that have phase 2 data that's been successful. They're moving into phase 3 programs. I'm most interested in them as a potential treatment for progressive MS. But we'll have to see how they do it in phase 3 because they're being looked at both in relapsing forms and in progressive MS. But I think it's a new molecular mechanism, and I'll be interested to see how they move along. Then we have a question on genetic link of MS. So this is the common question that they said is MS inherited? Is it genetic? And some have mistakenly said, no, it's not a genetic disease. It's not inherited, and that's just incorrect. What is correct is that it's not Mendelian. So it's a complex trait inherited. Which means that if there's MS in the family, you're at increased risk, but the risk is still low. So, for example, the risk of MS in the general population is about 1 in 700. But if you look at people who have MS in their family, they have 20 to 30 times increased risk, but that risk only goes up to 3 to 5%. But we know from twin studies. So monozygotic, identical twins, the concordance rate is at about 30%. And that's certainly higher than it would be for siblings, even fraternal twins. But it's not 100%, meaning there's something more than genes that's involved in inducing MS, something environmental that we haven't been able to identify just yet. Do you know of any data regarding diet and MS? Is a dietitian looking for data linked diet to reduction in symptoms or lesions? So no, there's lots of anecdotal reports about diet. There are no good studies that have shown one diet to be beneficial over another. It's a very complicated area to treat with. My colleague, Alana Katzman, has been studying diet and studying how to study diet because it's a very complicated, and it even gets to relating to what's going on in the microbiome, the organisms living in your intestines. So I don't have a diet to recommend. I tell people take a healthy diet, you know, Mediterranean maybe, but we do not have data, good data, to really guide us yet. I hope we will in the near future, but it's complicated. Well, unfortunately, that's the end of our time today. We've had many great questions, very terrific questions, and I'm sorry that we're unable to get to all of them. But before we go, let me remind you of key points or SMART goals for our program. They are with prognosis to determine the therapeutic approach to relapsing-remitting MS, partner with patients to discuss treatment goals to optimize outcomes, and integrate most recent clinical data into the treatment paradigm of patients with relapsing-remitting MS. Also, keep in mind that for additional clinician and patient resources on MS and other neurology topics, please visit cmeoutfitters.com. Stay safe, and thank you again for providing the best care to your patients.